WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Why don't we start out, if you could describe briefly what the geographical environment is like in the rainforest.
Okay, this is a tropical rainforest at about 2,000 feet altitude. It's not a real steamy, real hot rainforest. Doesn't get up beyond maybe 85 degrees. Rain, well, pretty much every day, every afternoon, like clockwork. And very dense vegetation. It's a very large area with a very sparse population. In an area of more than 500 square miles, you have, less than 2,000 people. So, you know, the actual amount of space in the environment that's exploited by people for food, for gardens, and so forth, very small indeed. So most of the forest remains primary virgin rainforest.
What's your visual sense there? It seems like you don't see very far.
You can't see very far at all. I mean, the people live in small villages. These are clearings which are cut sort of onto higher ridges in the forest. But aside from that, everything is traveled through little trails or less than little trails through the forest, constantly crossing streams. The whole area is just divided up in a million different ways. It seems very hard to keep track of where one stream starts and another one ends. Some of them are large, some of them are small. The people seem to have an extraordinary knowledge of which is a little tributary or a little branch of a larger river, all the kinds of things which are just totally disorienting for you when you walk through this environment. And even after spending a couple years there now and walking through it, I'm still constantly figuring out sorts of things which are major revelations to me and which they know, as well as, you know, the intersection of, you know, Walnut Street and Broad Street or something.
How is the community organized, especially in an environment where you can't see where the next clearing is, I guess, but they're spaced apart from each other but operate right as a community?
Well, people live communally in longhouses. These longhouses are really one big, large house where about 60 to 80 people, about 15 families, where they all reside together. And the longhouse is the center of a community being the clearing that's cut in the forest. And then the rest of it is all forest all around. Now, each one of these clearings is separated from the others by about an hour's walk through the forest. So to socialize with other people, it means, you know, not a major trek, but, you know, it's an hour of walk through the forest. Additionally, people have some small garden houses out in lands far away where they go to work. So people are spending a lot of time in the forest every day. They're constantly walking. So, you know, after 8 o'clock in the morning, the village is virtually empty. And then they come back in the afternoon.
The program that we'll be hearing is a soundscape, and it's in many ways a soundscape of the work day. It follows the pattern of the work. And what's the work day like? What's the schedule like?
Well, there are two major kinds of work which one both sees and hears all the time in the forest. And one kind of work is done in the gardens. It's often the case that gardens are being cleared. This is a kind of slash-and-burn agriculture there, where the trees are, where planting is done and the trees are actually knocked down right on top of the crop. And then the trees decay right into the ground and they shade the crop and protect it from the harsh sunlight. And so it's a lot of work to cut down these trees because most of them are like 125, 135 feet high. And they're quite big. And so people are working together, men largely cutting the trees while the women are clearing the brush with machetes. The other kind of work beside, you know, just sort of picking food in the garden is work at sago camps. Sago camp is a very special kind of sound. This is more a women's kind of thing than men. And sago is a, of food which is processed from the pulp of these palm trees. It's almost 100% starch, which is scraped out of these palms and then beaten into a pasty, manioc-like kind of food.
You brought a recording with you. What are we going to hear?
Well, you'll hear guys clearing lands for a garden. And the interesting thing about this is you just hear a very dense kind of sound. There's probably about 30 or 40 guys here. And it's a mixture of whooping and yelling and chopping and yodeling all across this large ridge where they're clearing the lands. Okay, that was a tree coming down there at the end. And what you heard before that, which was real nice, is the way the people are alternating lines as they're cutting into the trees. And it's this coordinated group singing and whooping which really organizes the work. Sometimes it's two or three men cutting one tree together. Sometimes it's a long row of trees being cut by a whole group of men. But you can hear how every cut into the tree seems paced with the singing they're doing and with the yodeling they're doing. And that also is reflected in that echo you hear. The sound is bouncing across the ridge and then bouncing back so that people on two sides of a hill can hear each other really well.
Did you have to adjust your own listening coming from, you know, an American urban environment, which is, I guess, relatively very sound polluted with, just city noise, cars, radios, sounds all the time, and going into a different environment. Do you have to change your listening or adjust your ears?
Yes, in a couple of different ways. One is that in an environment like the Kalulu one, you have to listen more. That is, you can't rely on vision. Quite often you have to locate things all around you and back of you along the sides of you by their sounds, because there aren't the kinds of reflections and there aren't the kinds of other visual things that you would expect. And also you can't see very far in front of you once you're in the forest. So that's one kind of adaptation. Now, in my particular case, I found that it was very difficult to tell the difference between the height of a sound and the depth at first. I often would look up, and in fact, it wasn't a sound that was very far above me. It was a sound that was deep in the forest. So it took a while to learn how to listen to the forest. That is, just to learn how to locate where the sounds were coming from. The other thing that's remarkably different there is the number of loud sounds. When I first went there, I just couldn't believe that there were no sounds louder than thunder. Now, when you grow up in an environment where routinely, riding on buses, on subways or whatever, this instantly drowns out a conversation. You have to speak three times louder when you're sitting on the subway with somebody. When you have daily experiences like that, it's really shocking to go into an environment where you don't hear very many loud sounds. And at the same time, you hear many, many soft sounds, sounds that you have to pay a lot of attention to to discriminate what they are.
So what you're saying is you don't hear sounds louder than thunder. That's about the loudest you'd ever hear in that environment.
Yeah, except for the visiting. When we came in, we come in on a little single-engine five-seater airplane. That's the most intrusive sound in the environment, the outside sound and the loudest sound.
How about other motors? Do you hear cars or construction engines or machines or anything like that? And does that stand out in the rainforest?
No, the missionary owns a tractor which he uses to keep the grass down on this 1,600-foot airstrip there where people can come into the area. But other than that, there are no sounds. You think of almost the opposite of the environment you know well. Here, when you think of the sounds around you, maybe 5, 10, 15% of them are natural sounds, 80, 85% of them technological sounds. The exact opposite in an environment like this. Maybe, 5, 10% of the sounds are technological sounds, and all the rest of them are human and animal and environmental. One thing that really strikes me about their society is how they seem so aesthetically oriented. They're very oriented into the pleasure and joy and the beauty and all the passion they feel relating to singing. At the same time, there's no concept of music.
Why do you say that? What do you mean?
I mean, there is no socially defined term, music. There is song and there is singing, and in fact, everybody in the society sings. Everybody in the society composes songs. And if you can't sing and if you can't compose songs, you're really not fully a human being. It's like not being able to speak language.
Are there tone deaf Kaluli?
No. And being able to listen to, respond to, feel, and understand sound is really right at the root of what it means to be a person there. First of all, you have to be able to interpret and be very adept at listening to sound in order to survive in this kind of environment. The fact is that living in an environment like that really develops awareness for sound as much as the awareness of vision, maybe even more. These people hunt by sound. They know all sorts of things by the sounds, the time of day, things about the weather.
Did they notice your relative noviceness when it came to reading the sound? Or did you ask for help in interpreting the sound?
Oh, yeah. I was just a complete klutz about these kinds of things.
What type of things would you have to ask for or ask about?
Well, one of the problems was that I always made too much sound. I mean, I was so much larger than them and so bulky moving around through the forest that they were always afraid to take me hunting because I would make too much noise. Wearing boots, in the bush, and they don't wear boots. But I was always asking about, I was always just kind of constantly moving around in circles and, trying to figure out where the bird was coming from or something like that. And they were, they always knew exactly where these things were. Once walking in the forest, I was on the trail with a bunch of guys and somebody just said, jump. And I jumped, and by the time my feet hit the ground, there was a poisonous snake in front of me with its head cut off. That's the kind of thing which I was just not very good at picking up and which to them is just, as natural as, day and night.
Could you introduce the song we're about to hear, the duet by the waterfall?
Yeah, this is something which is very poignant to me in my experience there. Kaluli people not only are inspired by the sounds around them, they like to sing with the sounds around them. And one day I was out recording a couple women who had been working in the garden, and one of them said to me, we're going to go find a good waterfall to sing with. And I just really couldn't believe this. It seemed so, I didn't understand. I thought I maybe misunderstood. And they actually went and found this place near them. It was a beautiful waterfall. And they sat down and they began singing these duets. And structure of the duets is one part sort of lifts up over the other. That is, there's no real distinct break between one voice and the next. And the constant shh, this kind of hissing background of the waterfall, was considered a real pleasing sound to sing with. And so they actually interact with the environment in a certain way.
What are they singing about?
This song is a song about a particular bird whose name is Io. And they're singing about the fact that they're singing a series of names of places. And they're singing about a child who is walking on a path from one place to another and calling back to its parents about not coming home. And the child is in the form of an Io bird, this little fruit dove bird. This is a very plaintive song. It's a song that had been composed about 10 years before for a ceremony.
A recording that Stephen Feld made in New Guinea from the record Music of the Kaluli, and that was two women singing at a waterfall, demonstrating some of the interaction of the sound environment and the song being sung. Are there times for silence, you know, where it's silence is expected among the Kaluli?
No. Kaluli are so energetically vocal, and when people are quiet or reticent or withdrawn, it's really very disturbing for people. Children are really very much encouraged to talk, encouraged to sing, and constantly one of the features of life there is that even when you have a little visual privacy, which is rare, there's no acoustic privacy. There is always sound, and I think it's very important for Kaluli. I think they get slightly edgy if you're quiet for too long. That was one of the things that I realized when I was learning the language, because when I would just interact by nodding my head or making some facial signs, they would get upset, you know. But if I would just say anything in any language, just try and make sounds.
Give a good uh-huh.
Yeah, they found that far more appropriate.
The tape we're about to hear is a soundscape. Mm-hmm. Could you explain that approach and tell why you wanted to use it?
Yeah. Two things. One is I've really done traditional kinds of research publications, articles. I've published some records. I've written a book about my work. One of the things that struck me was that because this group of people is so oriented toward sound and because the sounds themselves are so interesting to listen to, that one nice way to share the findings of all of this research with a really with a much wider audience. And also one way to use the most appropriate medium would be to produce some things for radio. And so I wanted to do something which would include narration, sounds of the environment, and the people singing, but which would not be just like playing a record, not just like songs, and not just a sort of lecture with a few examples. And that's one part of it. The other part of it is after I came back from New Guinea in 1977, my first research trip, I read a really wonderful book called The Tuning of the World by Murray Schafer. And Murray Schafer is a Canadian composer and researcher who founded what was called the World Soundscape Project and has put out many records and cassettes of soundscapes, that is, the sound environments of places all around the world. And this really encouraged me not just to study the music, not just the songs, not just the singing, not just the poetry, but the sounds of the environment and the interaction of the people in the environment. So I started getting more interested in recording people cutting trees down, not only when they would sing, or not just for the song or the words, but for just the sounds. And the sounds of the whole day, the sounds of night, the sounds of morning, the sounds of rain, every kind of environmental sound, every kind of human sound, every kind of animal sound, just what it feels like from the sound perspective to live there. What is a day in sound? And so that became the idea for the program, to do a 24-hour sort of day in the life of the sounds of the Bosavi environment.
Were there any particular technical challenges of taping in the rainforest environment? How did your equipment react?
Well, aside from the fact that you have to just live with getting rained on all the time, I was just off. I picked certain places in the forest and recorded during every hour of a 24-hour day over a period of 2 months, and made all sorts of different recordings, some of them with parabolic microphones which can record up to 1/2 mile away so that I could get certain bird sounds. But most of it just recorded with 2 stereo microphones and trying to get the feeling of the space of the forest. There's one problem that constantly confronted us in this, and which I was aware of. Because there's water everywhere, rain, waterways, and so forth, there are a lot of sounds which sound like hiss. And in fact, one of the engineers at the studio where we were working came in and said, gee, that's a great tape for measuring tape hiss, not realizing that these were actually sounds of insects and the sound of the forest. But when you're there, that's what this is like. It's this constant shh sound all around you, which you can never turn off. There's no kind of sound like the one we're hearing around us now in this studio. It's just that it's always a buzzing, pulsing, shimmering kind of sound, and it keeps changing throughout the day as some insects come, some go, rain comes, rain goes, birds come, birds go, and so forth. So it was a problem to record that accurately so it doesn't just sound like noise.
Were the Kaluli interested in hearing themselves on tape?
Oh, yeah.
How did they react to that?
Oh, they really liked that a lot. They become very critical of themselves.
Did they ever want another take when they heard something that they would have wanted to improve?
Well, with songs, yes, they would do that. But they when they hear a playback of tape, they constantly comment on what everybody else is doing. And they were constantly giving me advice about what to record, how to do it better. In fact, a lot of these tapes what I do in the field is I play them back for the people and ask a lot of questions about them because I would like this to sound like the experience, like, you know, what it's like for them.
Did you run into any particular challenges in the post-production of the tape and figuring out how to present this once you bring all these tapes back to a sound studio in Philadelphia?
Well, the main problem is that I'm too close to the material over all the time that I've done research, I've recorded 70 hours of sounds. So selecting 3 hours of material and then from that doing a half-hour show was enormous in itself. And in that, I wouldn't have been able to do it without a really good objective pair of ears helping me. And Scott Sinclair, my co-producer, really was just that. He was somebody who was interested and sympathetic, but he could really listen with a fresh pair of ears, which I couldn't. I knew all the people, knew all the situations, and was too sentimentally attached to some sounds which really weren't best for the program.